It is well accepted that Jaws is an all-time great film, but its progeny don't rank nearly as high. Two True Freaks is proud to present Is It Jaws, where Paul Spitero and Sean Whalen are joined by an all-star list of guest hosts to review old and new films and place them on the Jaws scale, where they're ranked from Jaws to Jaws 4. Of course, for the purposes of the show, that scale does take some liberties with their actual ratings. Sure, movies that are given the ranking of Jaws are considered classic films with few flaws, if any. A ranking of Jaws 2 indicates that the film is very good and worthy of repeated viewings. A Jaws 3 ranking indicates the film was okay, but that's all. A Jaws 4 means it's ranked as a bad movie. Oh, and if you ever saw Back to the Future Part 2, you know that there's a Jaws 19. That ranking indicates that the movie is so incredibly bad that it's actually fun to watch as a result. So please join Paul and Sean as they ask the ever-important question, is it Jaws?
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Is It Jaws? I'm Paul Spitero, and as is pretty much always the case, on the other end of the line is my good friend, Mr. Sean Whalen.
It is a pleasure to be here today.
It is Ichiban for you to be here today.
It sure is.
So, in the past, and I think this was all before you were part of the show, we have covered Yojimbo and Rashomon from Akira Kurosawa. But now, today, we're taking a look at his most acclaimed movie, The Seven Samurai. I saw The Seven Samurai back when I was in college. I'm pretty confident that what I did was I rented, for a dollar, the two-part VHS tape and watched it. And it was definitely in my I-would-love-to-be-a-filmmaker mode. Let me watch this because this is considered to be a pivotal movie. Mm-hmm. Since that time, I've seen clips here and there, but I've never sat down and watched it in its entirety until I did it to do the show today. And I have some interesting thoughts on it. And part of that is, although now I've seen this twice and I know this is the forebearer, I've seen The Magnificent Seven probably a dozen times easy, maybe more than that. And that was obviously an American remake of this movie, but that's the one that's imprinted itself on my brain. So I have a tough time watching this without comparing it to that, and I'm going to try my best to do that today and just, you know, leave that out for the most part because of it, you know, we're going to follow this up with doing that movie down the line. But it was difficult. It is difficult, honestly.
So I've never seen an Akira Kurosawa movie. This has been on my bucket list. You know, I've got like everybody who's a film fan, you've got those films that like I want to see. I've heard great things about it. I just never got around to this one. And so when you suggested it for this, I was like, oh yeah, let's please do this because I'd like to see it. And this is going to be a fun conversation because this was my first go around with this. I've never seen any of his movies. So it's, I actually got the episodes you've mentioned, I skip the ones of yours that I have not watched the film yet, because I want to watch the film and then enjoy, hear the commentary. So that's where I'm at with the Akira Kurosawa movies. So I'm excited for this to be my first foray in. I have lots of thoughts, as we often do when we talk about this. This will be an interesting one to discuss.
Well, just to touch a little bit more on the Akira Kurosawa thing, because I'm thinking a lot of people who are listeners of the show probably haven't seen his movies, because you're really only seeing his movies if you're a big film fan and want to see kind of the history and historic movies, whatever, because it's a chore. I mean, I don't mean to make it overly, because I enjoy the chore, but it's a chore because you have to deal with the fact that you're dealing with another language and another way of showing the movie. I think it's different. The two movies we already covered, and I just, without spoiling anything, but even about our, you know, about the movies, Rashomon was definitely groundbreaking in my opinion. And that you see a lot of TV shows and things where they use it for almost a comic element, which is not what that movie is, but I would absolutely recommend that for a filmmaking point of view. And I think it's not spoiling to say what that is where you see different things in the movie, different stories, different things, and they're shown from the perspective of the storyteller. So you're seeing the same scene different ways, because it's definitely the perception of the person who's telling it. And I've seen that on sitcoms in many, many occasions. And I definitely recommend that, because it's a fascinating foray into filmmaking. Yojimbo was eventually remade in the United States as A Fistful of Dollars. And that's another story, much like The Seven Samurai, that's been done in many, many ways. And that one I found a little bit less engrossing for me. And I think that may be a similar thing to this, in that I had A Fistful of Dollars I had seen many times. And actually, I think we reviewed A Fistful of Dollars a few years back on this show. So that was so much my groundwork for it that seeing the Japanese version of it was a little bit more difficult for me. So I didn't embrace it quite as much. But those are my, mini reviews as far as you're watching those two movies. I would definitely recommend them from the filmmaker curiosity perspective, though, no question.
This is well over 3 hours. So when you mentioned the chore part of this one, it really is more of there's a time commitment to this. You've got to be in the mood for a Lord of the Rings style epic. And I don't compare those lightly. I enjoy those movies, but I've got to be in the mood for those movies, because of the fact that you're sitting down and spending a lot of time watching it. The fact that it's subtitled is, you've got to be in the mood for the subtitles too. There's so much to talk about in this that works, which is going to be really interesting to discuss as far as a film goes, because you're right, it's very influential. And you can see it in as you watch it, you know, as far as, oh wow, a lot of films pulled from this, and you get why. There's casting is something that's going to be interesting, because I don't know the cast other than this particular film, but they did an amazing job of casting, because it's a big cast, and there's not a lot of, there's extras in this that are a part of it, but they do a really good job in giving this village life. And the fact that the villagers have personalities as well as the samurai, you know, usually in these big epic films where you've got like a certain cast that you're supposed to be focused on, it's not just your seven samurai. It is the village in general. And even people outside of this village, in the towns that they're going to, where they're trying to get the samurai, they all have personalities, and it's a rich, thriving world. This is ambitious in world building. And what's done here with scope and scale is something that is very, very hard to do. Usually we don't get this kind of big view. That's why the film is as long as it is. I think it does a great job of crafting something that feels living and thriving in a way that some films aren't able to accomplish on this level. It's a very interesting study as far as a film. I'm glad you picked this one, because it's one I've always wanted to see. So for anybody listening to any, looking for any of my biases on this one, admittedly, this has been my first watch through. So I've got a lot of new car smell for this one. but I'm able to look at it objectively too, as far as what, you know, did I enjoy the experience? And we'll talk about that along the way.
Yeah, just as a side note, because you mentioned it, you know, as you're aware, my wife went away for a few days last month. And while she was away, I watched the extended versions of all three of the Lord of the Rings movies. So, yeah, you know, sometimes watching a long movie like that is a chore. But, you know, when I use the word chore for that, I'm not talking about, oh, it's so hard. You know, it's such hard work. It's a labor of love. And I think this movie fits that category. If you are, I'm going to, you know, I'm always going to put the little asterisk on this one, that it is a foreign language film, and it's done, it was made in 1954. So it's got old style filming. Although I got to say, the version I watched, and it was a friend's copy, so I don't even know, you know, what version it is, honestly, but clearly it had been restored and cleaned up and it looked beautiful. So the fact that it's old doesn't make it, you know, grainy or just, you know, where the soundtrack is poor. Everything about it seemed very, very good. So I'm going to start off with, I think the most compelling thing about this movie, in my opinion, is that it created a lot of storytelling themes that I don't believe existed before this. And I don't remember ever seeing any movie that had them, you know, the gathering of the group and the, you know, to defend the village and all that. But it's been done so many times since that it's become a storytelling trope. And yet, and again, I'm not trying to compare this to the Magnificent Seven. I'm talking about all of the things that were influenced by it. It doesn't feel old. It doesn't feel like, I've seen this so many times before. It's done in a way where it actually feels fresh and clean. And in 1954, I have no question in my mind, it was fresh and clean. But now in 2026, excuse me, I was going to say 2024, you know, all these years later, I think it still comes off as an original story. You know, you're meeting all these characters and every one of them has a personality. And the story has its, you know, it has a natural flow to it. I thought the direction in the movie, and I'm kind of just jumping around here, so Sean, interrupt me anytime you want. But I thought the direction, it didn't have that Hitchcockian feel to me, that where it's like, oh, you know, everything about it is symbolic and, you know, the framing of this shot or the framing of that shot. It seemed to me to be a more natural storytelling mode where, you know, he just kept the narrative going with the way he directed it. And that really seemed to be his goal. That's the way it felt to me. I don't know. I wanted to review this fresh, even though I've heard things over the years and all of that. I'm trying to give my impression of it. I don't know if the film critics, because I haven't seen anything that they've said in many years. And I don't know if they saw it as more of a, oh, you know, in this shot, you see, you know, the angle shows this and that. And I don't know if that's there that I missed. It felt like a very, very clean storytelling version to me.
And I felt that too. It was, especially with so much going on, because the film has a lot going on. I felt the shots were clean. I feel like a great example of some of the things that I think that was done with this film, with the story. Usually you start out the film by like finding those likable people that you attach onto. The villagers aren't immediately likable, like, which is really interesting. And it plays later into the film in some critical ways when we learn about the history of the village and, you know, the farmers. And I really should refer to the farmers, because there is a class system in this that is pretty critical to the whole thing. And the farmers have a history that's not very good. There's the one younger farmer who is, you know, trying to kind of energize and say, like, we can't keep doing this. We've got to take a stand. But he may be the only one that's, like, early on that's likable. I would say the village elder is probably the one I like the most out of the whole batch. Just, and he's only in those spots where it's like, hey, we don't know what to do. Let's go to this guy and get advice. But I liked that because they don't have a lot to offer. They're not like immediately compelling and engaging where you'd go, man, I really like them. I want to go risk my life for them. and it adds to the struggle of they're hurting. Their village is hurting. They are being attacked and they don't have money to offer. They aren't immediately the most compelling people in the world. So they're seeking out samurai and they don't have this like bucket of gold to say, here, help us. And I love that they're having trouble getting people to help them to the point where they're being mocked. And in all of that, there's some great sequences where we're seeing emotion in the village. We're seeing the cast of characters in the village. Like there's the one villager who's constantly trying when they decide to go for samurai. He's very worried about them coming for his daughter, who's beautiful. She's bathing. She's washing her hair. And there's this beautiful sequence with her that I think is just really well shot because, you know, there's a point where, you know, certain things, this is not a movie that's geared to be titillating. And the sequence with her where you show it, it's very beautiful. It's very gorgeously framed. She's clearly a beautiful woman, but they didn't have to go somewhere untoward in order to make that. You just got to see her beauty in the way that the shot was framed, her long hair and all of that, which makes it so devastating later with what the father does when he starts chopping at it. There were some really good choices as far as showcasing beauty in this otherwise sad world that I thought was really, really well done. And you get why this film is one of those that's put on the map as far as you should watch this and kind of see what they did. I love black and white movies. And I feel like your filmmakers that leaned heavily into what a black and white film could do and with shading and tone and environment building, this is one of those where sense of scope and scale and everything, there wasn't a lot that looked like it was a set.
No, not at all. And I think it was a lot of sets actually, but it didn't look like it.
Yeah. I mean, that stood out to me because I don't remember being taken out of the film at some point in time going, they're not really there. They're not really in these like vast outdoor villages and things like that. I never had anything that was, and maybe you've got something. I don't, where I look back and go, man, that was jarringly something that they did indoors somewhere that should be outdoors. that's a success of the film. The set pieces, I think, were just incredibly well put together, where I felt like I was there never had to have that sense of disbelief of, this isn't really a living, breathing, thriving world. You mentioned watching Lord of the Rings. This epic movies like this sometimes require work because there's a time commitment to putting down with these. So when I'm saying chore, I'm in the fact that this one, I was at a conference this week and I watched it over two sittings. Literally, I stopped at the intermission, not knowing that there was an intermission. And it just kind of was a natural break. And then I watched the rest the next day, just because I didn't have the time to be able to devote to watch the whole thing in one sitting. And it watched really well with the intermission. So from a film creation standpoint, I thought that was a nice construction of this as well, that it does have an intermission. I watched the Criterion version. I don't know if the intermission's in every version of it, but it was a nice little break. They have this nice little musical interlude during the intermission that I actually quite liked, and this all worked. But it's something I'd be remiss if I say that I don't remember anything that looked like a set piece to me, and that's unusual. There's usually somewhere in a film where I'm like, oh, clearly they were doing this on a set, and this didn't have that for me, which was something I thought that stood out.
Yeah, we've talked a couple of times in the past about, you know, colorization and all of that. This is not a movie that would benefit from colorizing at all. There are one or two scenes, or maybe more than that, but there's a couple of scenes where you're outdoors and they kind of show the scope of the land a little bit, you know, where the bandits are coming from or that kind of thing that might look a little nicer in color. But otherwise, I think Kurosawa really did use, as you say, the shadowing to kind of create moods at times, whether it was bright moods or dark moods. I think he used that, and I think you'd lose it if you added color to this. So this is not a movie that I would be championing that particularly. You know, we've talked about it a few times, and I think it sounds like I'm a big colorization fan sometimes, and I think certain movies would benefit from it. This is not one of them. I think that's the best way to put it. When I talk again about this being a little bit of a chore, and, you know, again, it's a foreign language movie, so you're working on that. You have many characters in this movie, so you're trying to keep track of who's who. And it, you know, at times it was a little difficult. Some of the samurais kind of blended together for me. I mean, the main guys, I think the four main ones that really kind of stood out were the main Ronin, you know, who they first take on. And then there's the young guy who wants to be a samurai that's with him. The second in command, the guy who ends up in the sword fight. See, and I don't know any of them by name. And then the one who comes along later, who's, they say is a samurai, but he really kind of isn't. And he's a farmer, and he's the most loud and boisterous of the bunch. And he's Toshiro Mifune. I'm pronouncing that probably terribly, who's the main guy in Rashomon. And he, as I understand it, was a very, very big star in Japan at the time. So, you know, he really stood out. Those were the four. The other ones kind of sometimes I had a little bit more difficulty kind of keeping track of who's who. And that's probably a personal weakness of mine as opposed to the movie being put together in a bad way. You know, I always wonder when I watch one of these, if I watched a dubbed version, would I be able to follow it better? And I generally don't like dubbing because it usually comes off as very, very corny, and it makes me kind of cringe a little bit sometimes. But I wonder if it would have been easier to follow the characters if I wasn't having to read the words as it went along.
This is a film that traditionally would have been, I don't want to diminish it by saying this, but like I didn't want it to be Kung Fu Theater.
Yeah.
Where sometimes when you get that dubbing, it becomes comical in the wrong way. Which, and I love Kung Fu Theater, by the way, so it's weird. I'm saying it like I'm knocking it. I'm not. But you got to be in the mood for Kung Fu Theater. This is not that. I think this was better served by being subtitled because of the fact that I wanted this to feel like the serious epic that it is. I'm with you on the names of them, and I think because you're reading them and not really able to register them in the same way. But one of the things I think that this film did that was key, the introduction to the samurai is engaging. When they're in that village and you're seeing many samurai pass and they're like, no money? I'm not doing any of this. I love that we got to see a very thriving, active town where they went to the right spot to seek people out. I like that they were getting a lot of no's. And even the monk, when he was, the original samurai, and the reason why I call him a monk, he was introducing himself as a monk originally. I like that our introduction to him was him basically walking over to the building and looking like he's going to do a peaceful resolution to the whole thing. Then he hopped into the building. Like, you give those rice cakes over there. Then he hopped into the building and it was like lightning. It was a really well shot sequence with him because he does not look like a guy that you're going to see that's going to be very spry until he is. And he hopped into that building, came out. Baby's okay now. He chased out the bandit that was in there. It was a really cool sequence of events that showcased him. But I like that each samurai got an introduction. And we got to see that they aren't cookie cutter. They had little personalities and things like that along the way. Clearly, we had our main people that we were supposed to focus on. I dug him quite a bit. He had like one of the samurai were like his second in command. You know, the one that he was constantly with. Mm-hmm. And liked their relationship because there was some humor every so often. Also, the fact that the two of them were so comfortable with each other, even when they were walking around the village together and analyzing things, he had that confidant that he trusted his experience. And I did like that interplay. Again, I'm not throwing out names because similar reasons that you're talking about, but I did like the relationships that we were seeing in the samurai group. And our master samurai, the one who is the swordsman who we got to see do all like the amazing stuff, like the one guy, he was doing a duel with the one guy, and they were sparring with, you know, basically so they weren't going to get killed or anything like that. And the guy's like, no, we're going to do this now with real swords. He's like, why do you want to do that? I'm going to kill you. And he kept telling her again, like, let's not do this. I'm going to kill you. And lo and behold, he killed him. And exactly like he said. And I love that his quest was to constantly improve and better himself. And his reason for being with that group was the opportunity to do that. He had a different sort of code, a sort of operating what he was trying to do. And I think we all knew he was going to come. He was almost like their Wolverine, for lack of somebody else. You know, if I'm looking, he came in and you knew that he was going to be the badass that was going to join the group. And I liked that he had that presence. I like when he came in this like, oh, okay, that's cool. The young samurai in training. I love that he was glued to him. I admired not only his skill, but his nobility. Like he felt like, you are this learned, good person. And he grew to admire and adore him, and even to a certain extent, love him from a certain extent, as, you know, like this mentor he could put on a pedestal, and saw somebody that hopefully he could train with and gain that. I loved that framing. This is where screen time in this one, I think it needed every bit of the time. I don't feel this film had anything wasted in it. Did you? I mean, was there anything you'd cut from this one?
No, absolutely not. I think it was. It's almost a contradiction in terms, but like 3.5 hours, and it still felt lean. It felt like the story. And again, I think that's why this story is so groundbreaking, because mm-hmm. there's so much that's introduced to it, and so many things that other filmmakers have seen and said, "Ooh, I want to make a story like that." You know, there's the obvious remakes, but there's also just like one of the movies that was clearly highly influenced by this. And I don't want to go too much into to that stuff now, but one of the ones that was highly influenced by this, that was not a remake of it by any stretch of the imagination, but The Dirty Dozen. You know, it's you still have all the, you know, the introduction of the characters, and then they're on the mission, and all, you know, and not all of them survive. And, you know, there's a lot of stuff that, again, became filmmaking tropes that were not at the time. And I think this was, I think, you know, we'd be remiss if we downplayed the influence that this movie had on filmmaking, just in general, certainly action filmmaking. And it's not a nonstop action fest. This isn't, you know, Raiders of the Lost Ark, where it's, you know, you go from one action scene to another action scene. There are many, many, you know, moments where you're learning about the characters and you're kind of getting into their motivations. Like I said, some of the samurai, you don't really get a true feeling for everything that's motivating them or their history. Although you do get the feeling that every one of the actors had a backstory that they were working with, that even if you don't know about it, there's more to these characters than you're seeing. And I think that made it feel richer. I want to kind of circle back a little bit to something you hit on, just because I thought it was really key to the story, even though it's not really put front and center all that much, is the conflict among the villagers. Mm-hmm. Just the idea that, you know, take this is a movie that takes place in the 1500s. Mm-hmm. Take it into the, you know, the current day and age, in the same kind of situation, and you can kind of even relate to the characters a little bit. And, you know, they need help. They know they can't handle it on their own. They are basically coming out and saying, what we can offer you is virtually nothing, so we need you to come and help us based upon your sense of honor and your sense of wanting to, you know, take care of the more oppressed, because all I can offer you is food, which is, you know, it's something, but it's not much. And then they have to be able to trust that the people who are coming aren't there to rape their women or steal their, you know, whatever little things they have, or pillage them, you know? So there's such a conflict there. And then they don't even have total confidence in that they're going to be successful in doing this.
Right.
So you have the ones who
you know, who want to go basically for appeasement. You know, okay, we'll give them what they ask for and we'll just beg them to let us keep enough to feed ourselves. So there's, you know, there's so much conflict going on with the villagers that it makes the backstory so much richer for the samurai and what's going on with them. They're not totally welcomed and loved by the villagers. And you know, I'm jumping around a little bit, but you see it at the end when the main guy who's Shimura, I can read it on my screen at least, you know, when he comes out and says, we didn't win this battle. The only people who won were the villagers.
Right.
You know, and I think that's giving the story a tapestry behind it that just makes it so much more interesting to see what's going on with these villagers and with these samurai and what they're dealing with. We really don't get any backstory whatsoever for the bandits, you know, but we just know they're an evil force that's coming, and we know they're coming and it's inevitable. So, you know, you're also working with a time restraint. We need to be ready by the time they come, and we don't know exactly when they're coming. We just know they're going to wait for the crops to be ready.
And what's known is that the bandits have an immense amount of resources because this is what they do. They go to these villages and they take everything that they can. And the idea is they don't completely pillage the villages because of the fact that they want to come back again and get more. So they'll take everything. And the villagers know that, like, when the food's gone, they're going to take the women. They're going to take anything that they possibly can. So you're dealing with samurai who are coming to a village that doesn't provide an immense amount of resources for them. They don't have a whole bunch of weapons sitting there or anything like that. None of that's available at all. And I liked that we were in on the planning, you know, with the samurai. You know, we got to see them walk around the village and get to know the various areas of the village. Like, hey, when are you gonna pull the crop? Because we need to flood this area. We're going to build fencing here. And a lot of that led to strategy. Like, even the fencing wasn't just there to keep them out, like, when the battle starts. It was to, when the scouts came, for them initially to learn from the scouts, then learn from the first wave of bandits that were attacking. That's how they learned about the guns that they had and things like that. Like, now we're samurai with swords. We're dealing with numbers that are larger than ours. And these guys got guns. I liked that every layer of the bandits, they were coming in with some additional resource that the village would not have access to and would not be able to pull up. And it was something that the samurai had to plan for and encounter. I liked the whole layout. I liked when the two elder samurai, were walking around the village and making plans along the way for particular areas. And that's when we got to see them split off a bit, and we got to see the talents of some of the other samurai in constructing a way to protect this village that is not structured for a war or for to survive a war. And that was something that I thought was really interesting in this. It started to make this world, again, feel alive. I'm with you that I liked that the samurai were there and that the villagers, not only were they not welcoming them, some of them were flat out rude. And honestly, if I were a samurai, I don't know how long I'd stick around in that environment where, you know, you've got people yelling and screaming and hiding their women because of the fact they think the samurai are going to take them. Because that was the concern, is the samurai are going to come here, they're going to take our women. So I want you know, like, the one wanted his daughter to look like a boy. Wasn't the only one. There were other villagers that had similar feelings off of that because of the fact that we're going to make her off-putting for the young samurai who ended up, there was a young samurai who ended up falling in love with her. And that was another area where they lost, because that young love could not wind up being because of the pressures of this village and the way that it operates.
And that subplot was kind of big too, though, because, you know, you saw why the father had fears of what was going on. Mm-hmm. And you can, you know, you can kind of understand, okay, I have my daughter, this guy's coming in, he's a, you know, he's a rogue, and he's gonna, you know, I don't trust that he's gonna fall in love and give up the samurai lifestyle and stay here and become a farmer. So I think he's gonna, you know, basically drain my daughter of whatever life she has and then leave. and I'm going to have a shell here. You know, not he's not going to do it the way the bandits are doing it, but he's going to do it just the same. That's his fear. Now, that doesn't happen. They fall in love, and, you know, there's the night before when they know, okay, tomorrow this is coming, and they, you know, they are romantic, and the father is ready to disown her over it.
Yeah.
And you know, he not only disown her, but he's like beating her. Mm-hmm. And it's a very uncomfortable scene to watch, you know, because, you know, her motivations were understandable, and the samurai's motivations were understandable, and neither one of them seemed villainous in what they were doing. And yet the father is treating her like she's, you know, like she's just a horror, you know, and it was, like I said, it was difficult to watch, but it was also, it lent itself to the depth of this movie.
I liked in that sequence that the young samurai didn't attack the father and stop the father. Now, let me get it wrong. The father was wrong. Beating the daughter was not a good thing. The thing that I liked was the humanity. He was a deer, the young samurai, because we knew that he wasn't experiencing things like that, was like a deer caught in the headlights. He didn't know what to do. And I liked the humanity of that. Like, he was watching this unfold. And there's usually in these, you know, when there's a father who's abusing, or, you know, and or doing something like that, I'm kind of used to the film trope of somebody comes in and saves the day and saves the girl and things like that. That's not always the real world. And I liked that in that sequence, I hated the father, like what he was doing right now. I'm like, boy, dude, you're going a little too far here right now. This is young love and things like that. And I get that all your fears, I get. We saw them manifest throughout the film, but I liked that I didn't like him, and I wanted to smack him upside the head. But I loved that in that sequence, the extreme nature of it, I liked that the young samurai didn't immediately know how to react and did it in a way that you would normally see in film, just because it added more of a reality to me. You know, of as humans, we don't always do the right thing in those sequences. We don't always step in at the right time. Sometimes there's that hindsight's 20/20 where you go back and go, geez, I should have done something here. Or I wish I had handled this differently. I wish I had talked to the father ahead of time so we never got to this point. All those kinds of things. I love that this was one of those sequences. It made them feel more like real people to me versus characters in a film, because of the fact that it didn't go to something that I consider a film trope of, you know, kind of the hero comes in to save the day. That didn't happen there. It was ugly. It was dirty. And that's the real world. You know, there's sequences that are dirty sometimes. We learn from them. And I thought this was one of those moments. And it was something that I thought the writing on it was really strong, because it felt very real. Not because it was this heroic moment, it was because it wasn't, in a film that's about heroism in a lot of ways. And I like that there was very human moments throughout this, with not just the samurai, but with the villagers. And that part of it made this film feel much more rich because of it. There were some good choices.
Agreed. I totally agree with that. I also liked that they had the training sequences of the villagers where they're helping to teach them how to help them defend the village. But you're not depending on, you know, one of these villagers becoming the big hero. You just need them for effectively for volume, so that the bandits can't just come in and overrun the samurai, you know, by virtue of superior numbers alone. And we didn't get one of the things that, although I enjoyed the sequences in, I'm going to say Return of the King, because that one was the one where it was most clear to me. Mm-hmm. There were scenes in Return of the King that I enjoyed, where our heroes, who, you know, this Lord of the Rings was, I think, influenced by this as well. But yeah. There's scenes where they're overrun by the orcs and the villainous people, and you see they're surrounded and they just fight their way through it, through you know, far superior fighting skills, and they walk out, you know, some of them unscathed after, you know, fighting off 150, 200 different people or creatures. That never happened in this. You never had that sequence where somebody's like totally surrounded and he just pulls out his sword and kills 12 people with one swing of his blade kind of thing. And while it worked in Return of the King to a great extent and it felt very energetic and I enjoyed watching it, I don't think that would have worked here, and they didn't do it here. You know, the battle sequences felt realistic. You know, it felt like the villages and the samurai had a good plan and followed that plan. And what they did was they thinned out the bandits' numbers little by little. And they had their little chart, you know, their chalkboard chart where they would just cross off. You know, they kind of knew how many people they had to take care of. And as they'd kill them off, they'd put a check mark that, okay, you know, they have this many fewer people now. So they knew what to plan for. And I thought that all, like, presented really, really well throughout this movie. Again, I just felt like it had a real feel to it, and I think that's the key to me.
You touched on something there that I think was really good about the plan too, was the fact that we got to see them, like each of these plans were, each of these little attacks that the samurai, they were letting a few people in. And I like that they didn't all go well, like with the scouts. They didn't want to be seen, but then you had your bold and brash Kukuchiro, you know, our young guy who was a farmer originally, but kept telling everyone he was a samurai, but he was another one who came from shame of, you know, being a farmer and wish he'd done something more and kind of devoted his life to try to become more of a samurai, to as an outrage against all of this, to try and do something. I liked his character quite a bit as we got to know him. And I like that he added a comedic element to this, while at the same time he looked fierce, he looked imposing, and he wanted to fight and he wanted to help, and he was effective. But a lot of times he screwed up because he isn't a samurai. He's playing a samurai, and there's a huge difference between that. He comes stomping around when they're all trying to hide because they don't want the scouts to see them, because it will blow up the plan. It blew up the plan because of the fact that they saw him. Then they saw the samurai, and now you've got these scouts that know everything. I liked the one sequence where they were trying to let just one or two or three, you know, whatever, into the village, so that way they could take them down. And we got a couple extra horses in the village, and it went wrong. They took care of it, but that's where people got hurt. That's where the plan fell awry. This was not clean all the way through. I do like that when you've got something that on paper, it worked for them. They won-ish, you know, at the end. I mean, obviously we saw the deaths and everything that happened over there. So there was casualties. Their plan worked, but it wasn't clean. And there were things that went wrong along the way. That's where I think you're right. The Lord of the Rings films, I'd be surprised if we didn't find out that Peter Jackson watched this film and wasn't at least on some level influenced by it, because it has moments like that I think just work really well for me.
Yeah, I definitely think so. I liked that the main samurai, Shimura, he came up with a basically simple strategy to vet the incoming samurai as to whether or not they really were samurai or not. And that was to have the young guy stand there with a club and be ready to bop them over the head when they came walking in. And they explained it really well, because he was like, well, that's not right. You can't come at them that way. You know, it's unfair. And he's, if they're samurai, you'll never touch them. And you saw, you know, several people came in and he would do it and they would just evade it with ease. And then he would discuss with them, and some of them signed on and some of them didn't. But then when Kikuchiyo, I am terrible with the names, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. But when he came in, he bopped them on the head and you know, he was already hung over or whatever. And it made for a comical but yet threatening scene, because he started going after the young guy. And you were thinking, okay, if you're the young guy, what do you do here? And he kind of ran from him. He didn't really stand up to him at all. And I kind of expected, I thought this is where they subverted my expectations. I expected him to stand up at some point and say, that's it. You know, I'm going to defend myself. And he never did. And eventually, you know, he calmed down and they said, all right, you know, you're not a samurai, get out of here. And then he followed them. And it was, I mean, it was really well done.
One of the samurai ran from him too. And what I got out of that, and I was glad to see actually, because it would have taken away from the young Katsushiro, I think is how, what his name was. I'm looking, I've got a list of the names right here and I'm probably horribly butchering it, but the young samurai in training, he ran from him, but one of the other samurai did too. And the reason why I liked more of the veteran samurai ran from him, I got the idea of, this is a guy who's drunk. This is a guy who we aren't really going to battle with. There's not a motivation to fight him. So I got that they were more having fun with him than, you know, there was some real opposition here. They didn't feel he was a threat, other than the fact that he's angry. So
they didn't want to necessarily slice him up for no reason, because he, you know, he wasn't the enemy.
There's a subplot I'd like to talk about just a little bit, because there was a villager who's, anytime he was asked about taking a wife, he was incredibly violently, I wouldn't say defensive, he was violent about it. I mean, it was like, do not talk to me about this. He shut everyone down and usually left the sequence angry on some level. You know, obviously very early on it established that something has happened. Did she die? You know, my first thought is they killed her. You know, the bandits had killed her. What happened was worse. The bandits took her. And it led to this wonderful sequence. And I think it was just a brilliant sequence where he encounters her finally in the village, or where the bandit village is, he was going to be their guide to the bandit village. And when he gets there, he sees his wife. And boy, the sequence where the two of them encounter each other, we never really know everything that happened there, other than the bandits took her wife. But she is so mortified. And is it shame? Is it shame at him that he did not rescue her? Is it her own shame because of the fact of what she did with the bandits? She cannot go with him. She ends up going back into the building. And we know that, you know, my assumption is she died there. That sequence was one where what I loved was, I didn't know totally why she was backing away from him. I thought there was multiple layers to it. Shame at him. Like, why didn't you do anything for me? You know, and feeling that way about her husband. Also this kind of, I can't go back to that after all of this. And I loved that sequence because of just how horrid what had happened was, you know, and what had she done to survive? And it's an interest, you know, and did she fall for one of the bandits? You don't know any of that stuff, you know, as that's all playing out. And I loved it. I thought it was just a really good, because they didn't feel the need to give us narrative for every little tiny thing. The things that they left you to think about what happened there, I think were very effective, because that's real as well, right? We don't always know all of the stories. And I was glad with that sequence. It was a subplot that went all the way through. We knew enough at the end to get like this conclusion to it. And what they didn't tell us, I think, was just as powerful as what they did. And it was a really well-written sequence that reoccurred throughout the film. And I'm glad they gave us some form of conclusion to it, because it was very effective, I thought, at how horrifying this whole bandit thing is. And I love that I didn't have a clean idea on everything that may have happened with her. There was a lot of layers to it. And the layers, I think, are there because they didn't tell me. And I'm glad they didn't tell me. I think it was...
I agree with you totally. I think that it's a very, very dangerous thing, honestly, to start adding storylines in that you're not going to give a resolution to and you're not going to give full explanation for. And I'm certainly one who generally will be critical when that's done poorly, because I feel like, you know, I want to know. I want you to tell me what happened. But in the right event, in the right sequence, that can be critical to give depth to the story, to give depth to the tapestry of which the story is being told, to show that there's a lot more going on. This isn't, you know, such a simple thing where you see everything and you know everything. There's more stuff going on behind the scenes that you're not necessarily getting handed to you or spoon-fed to you. And again, I think it's dangerous because if you do that too much, the audience is going to rebel and say, you know, there's just too many hanging threads here that I don't know about. But if you do it just the right amount, it creates, like I said, more depth to the story and its background. And I think here is where that did happen, because those characters are not critical to the overall narrative, but they are critical to creating a feeling of reality to this village. So I think, you know, it created a very tenuous, dangerous balance that worked. That's kind of how I saw those little background pieces that they gave us on some characters.
I agree. I couldn't agree more.
I thought it was interesting to listen, you know, and I was watching this. This is one of these movies where, you know, I did start to get engrossed in the story, and I started watching it more as a viewer than as a critic. And I think that's a positive thing when it happens, when I can't help but get pulled in. But I try to pay attention to certain things that I normally would just kind of like allow myself to just ride the river of. And soundtrack and scores are usually that for me, and I've talked about that in the past, where if the score feels intrusive, if it feels like it's, oh, you know, well, like you're listening to the music and you're not paying attention to what's going on in the story, that's where the soundtrack might fail, because it has to emphasize and help the story, but it can't overpower it. So sometimes I sit back and the music does influence me, but I don't really take note of it all. So I had to fight a little bit to take note of the music. And I thought it was interesting, and I could be wrong on this, but it sounded to me like there was some traditional sounding Japanese music to set a tone, but that there was also a more modern, and by modern, I mean 1954, Americanized score, where there were themes for certain things that went on. And again, I didn't want to cross over too much to this, but I thought that some of the themes in the music were adapted or adopted or taken, you know, influencing what we get in the Magnificent Seven, which is what I consider to be one of the greatest scores of all time. So I have to give this score high ratings just for the feelings that it gave me throughout it. I thought it was really, really solid. And that was my very, very long way of saying that.
No, I couldn't agree with you more. I really enjoyed the music in this. I also enjoyed the use of sound in general. I mentioned before how this felt like a living, breathing, vibrant world, and nothing felt like a set. I think music and sound effects and sound use in general in all of this was very, very well played. There was nothing that I think took me out of the feeling that this was all really happening. And sometimes a musical score will work against, you know, it sometimes goes so over the top and tries to be such a loud, booming voice that it takes you out of a film, you know, where it doesn't complement what you're supposed to be emotionally feeling and where you're supposed to be riding along at the time. This one, the musical choices in this really, I felt, were added to the environments. They went along with the action that was going on in sequences where they were planning, you know, everything really just was complementary to the story that was being told here and where they were trying to emotionally take us. This is really, really something where if you're looking to, and I get why this is one of the ones that they say you should watch if you're, you know, interested in filmmaking. I think they did a really good job in the strategic choices they made with everything in this. It really had an interesting environment. One sequence, and I'm sorry, I don't mean to jump back to this. I don't want to leave this one out because it stood out for me. When they discovered the samurai armor, was in the farmer's village. Then they're asking the samurai asking the question, where did you, they're angry, furious. Where did you get this? And I love that it was our impulsive samurai, you know, samurai wannabe, who was there, who was the farmer. This is when we discover that he was a farmer, because of the fact that we didn't know his backstory. We knew that he wasn't a samurai, but he was telling everyone that he was a samurai. We knew that he wasn't giving his real name in the things that he was doing. And I love in that sequence, you know, he was like, all, look at this. They have all this stuff here. We can use this stuff. And they're like, you don't understand. What they have there means that they killed samurai. At some point in time in this village, they killed samurai. We can't defend them. And this was really going to be a breaking point. I mean, everything was going to fall apart right here. They're ready to, they're done. They're like, well, what do we do here? You know, and this is like, for the samurai, it's like a crisis of, why are we defending these people? Why are we even here?
Right.
Moment, until he chastises them and basically comes at it from the farmer's standpoint. That was the light bulb moment for the samurai. They're like, you're one of them. Like, not necessarily that group, but you were raised a farmer yourself. And that reality of the fact that that was what was motivating him to fight, to be there, to do those pieces, all of a sudden for them, because I love that the villagers come at that point in time, a couple of them, and confront the, or not confront, they go to talk to the samurai. And I love that the elder samurai was kind of like, at this point, oh, we're good now. Nothing really to talk about. Don't really just care. Whereas I think 10 minutes beforehand, he might have chopped somebody down. they were in that place. So right. I loved that sequence because it, again, was a great character development and great character building. We had seen so much of this erratic guy that I wanted to know, like, what is his deal? What is his backstory? I love the reveals in this film. And that was an example of a reveal that paid off in this horrific moment, where they're like, you wronged samurai before and did that. And it's another great example of, again, soundtrack and sound, that whole sequence as you're going through. It was a beautifully well put together sequence where a lot of the emotional build was driven by everything in the filmmaking environment. And this film just accomplished a lot in 3.5 hours. I never felt bored during it. Sometimes,
no, not at all.
I've got to be in the mood for an epic, because there's sometimes slow spots, and I like long form storytelling. So I'm good with an epic, but you have to be in the mood for an epic sometimes. This is not one where there was dead air, where I was like, oh, geez, I love this film and I'm glad they've got that sequence in there, but man, is that a trudge? This didn't have anything that felt like a trudge to me, which in 3.5 hours to be able to say that, I'm kind of going back to something I said earlier, but I think that's the victory of this film. There's nothing that was a trudge at all in this. That's hard to do. Hard to do.
Agreed. Totally agree. All right. Anything else we want to hit on before we give our ratings? And I think people probably already know what our ratings are.
Yeah, no, I'm good. I think I got everything out in this that really kind of stood for me.
Well, I think your description just now totally hit it on the mark for me. This is an epic. There's no question it's an epic. It's 3.5 hours, and it is rich while you're watching it. It's not a movie that drags. I think you could have a long movie that drags, and then it's not an epic. It's just a boring story. This one is an epic tale, and it is a tale that has become traditional now, that it's been done so many times in so many different ways, where it's influenced so many things. But again, watching this, it didn't feel like, oh yeah, this is all old stuff that I've seen before. It still felt original in its own way. I do think you have to get the right mindset to watch this in 2026, because it's an old black and white movie, and it's in foreign language, and it's very, very long. And if you are somebody who's just opposed to those things on principle, then you're not going to like this. But if you are willing to give it a chance, if you are interested in movie making, if you're interested in epic stories with rich characters, this is up there with the greatest of all time. Not only is this Jaws, this is in the elite Jaws class, as far as I'm concerned. This is one of the greatest movies of all time. And if they were making a top list of, you know, the movies that need to be maintained and seen by people who are making films for to learn how to do it, this would be very high on the list. It's just a great movie, in my opinion.
I really enjoyed my time with this movie, and that's kind of a key. And it's something I want to go back to. You and I both used the word chore before. I want to go back and you corrected along the way as far as there's different variations of what a chore means. And I agree with you. When you're watching an epic, there's a time commitment. There's also the subtitle piece of this. And that's something just to remember if you're a viewer who got to be in the mood for subtitles or don't like subtitles at all, I still think you should give this movie a shot because I think it absolutely is a Jaws for me. And I agree with you putting it in an elite class too, because I think it is that film. It feels special. It feels different. It feels influential. But it also was fun. And that's something I think that needs to be key here. For me, for a movie to be Jaws, it has to be where like, I enjoyed the movie. I really enjoyed this. So it's something where with those pieces, with it being so long, and with it having subtitles and the fact that there's a little more work when you're dealing with a film like that, the fact that I can come back afterwards and go, I watched this in two sittings because of my time availability, not because it was a problem. It was just, that was what my time availability was. I loved my time with this film. I loved the characters. I loved the environment. I loved the world. And I will go back to it again. It is one of those that I'm so glad that we do this podcast, because I don't know that I would have, I think I would have eventually gotten to it because I love to see films that are known quantities, but I certainly got to this faster because you texted me and said, hey, what do you think about doing this? I'm like, yeah, I've always wanted to see it anyway. Let's do it. And I'm so glad that we do this podcast because of this. And I hope for somebody listening to this, if you also had this on your list, maybe this was your gateway to watch this film, because I think that's part of what we do here is hopefully turn people onto things that they should be watching or they should check out if you're a film fan. This is one that, oh, needs to be on the list. This was good.
Absolutely. So, you know, we are going to follow up on this. I know I definitely want to do The Magnificent Seven. There's no question. I would kind of like to do, but I'm not going to push the envelope too much if you don't want to. I would kind of like to do the sequels to that, even Return of the Seven, The Guns of the Magnificent Seven, and
I've got them.
Okay, as do I. Yeah. There's also, you know, the 2016 version of the Magnificent Seven. There's Battle Beyond the Stars, which is considered to be a version of this, and there are other versions that I think I'd like to touch on over the years. Even A Bug's Life is a kind of a remake of this in its own way. The Three Amigos is a comedy remake of this. There's so many different things where they've done it. Galaxy Quest is listed as one of the movies that was, you know, kind of a, you know, enlisted in this one. I'm just looking at the Wikipedia page where they talk about different movies that are based on this, and they mentioned the Lord of the Rings trilogy. They mentioned Clone Wars, and an episode of The Mandalorian. There's so many things that this influenced. So we're definitely, at a minimum, we're getting to The Magnificent Seven, and then we'll see where we go from there. But I would like to kind of keep going with the tapestry that was formed by this movie. And we'll see how much, you know, we have a lot of things on our plate that we're trying to cover. So we'll work it in little by little as we do it.
It's fun. I'm glad we did this. By the way, I haven't, just to not barely on this one, I've never seen Magnificent Seven.
Wow. Okay. That's going to be fun then.
So I grabbed it in its sequels because of the fact that you texted, hey, you want to do these? I'm like, sure. I've heard great things. I want to see it. I got a big list of films I want to see. So I love when we get to do stuff like this where it pushes something that I haven't seen before. So I'm that audience member who hadn't seen this, and I'm glad we did it today. I'm looking forward to when we do Magnificent Seven.
Magnificent Seven is one that I've seen enough times that it's one of my comfort food movies. I could just put it on and I don't even have to watch closely because I've seen it so much. I know every scene. So I'll look forward to getting to that with you.
Okay. Sounds good.
All right, everybody. Thank you for listening and we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Kurosawa was interested in morality and the actions of men in battle.
Kurosawa in Seven Samurai shows us that he's one of the great poets of screen violence. He's going to give us, if not more fights, then fights filmed in a way that had never been filmed before.
When you see Seven Samurai, you sort of move forward in your seat. Your muscles are tense when you see this picture. Simply the physicality of Seven Samurai was overwhelming. And on a kinetic level, you're right in there with it. I'd never had an experience like this.
Kurosawa would have been the first to say that violence, even in the good, interesting pre-war films, was always much too aestheticized. It looked too pretty. Definitely kabuki-derived, much closer to dance in some ways than sword fighting. But even when they kind of tone it down for cinema, it's very stylized. The biggest difference that Kurosawa brought right off the bat to the samurai film in Seven Samurai is to get rid of all that stuff. He's making a kind of abstraction of that choreography, and it seems more realistic. He really brings a new style of fight choreography to the samurai film.
We do have many of the attributes of Chambara, but they are all dignified. They're not trivialized. We feel every death, even the death of the bad guys, the bandits. We know what death means. This is one of the first of the samurai pictures which really lets us know what death is all about. It's not decorative.
Death and violence are nasty and dirty and brutish and shocking. When people die, they're dying in the mud. And although Seven Samurai isn't especially violent, both at the time and even today, it's presented in a way that no one could ever accuse it of being glamorized.